Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we've gathered together some of the best of the cookbook world for some vicarious travel. We begin with Southern food evangelist, Chef Sean Brock. His book, South, breaks down the essential elements of Southern cuisine.
I wanted to create a book that allowed me to share all the things that I've learned through my insane research and development and my obsessive, compulsive nature of just trying to make the best version of these classics.
Then we meet Marty Buckley, author of Basque Country.
Food for them is everything, and it's very important. And that's something, growing up in Alabama and also having lived in Louisiana for a few years as well, was something very familiar to me.
Cookbooks are taking us places on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Federal law enforcement will start leaving Portland tomorrow following weeks of clashes with some civil rights activists who've been protesting against police misconduct. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Dirk Vonderhaart reports a departure as a result of a deal between Governor Kate Brown and high-level Trump administration officials.
In exchange for a drawdown of federal officers, Brown has agreed to use state troopers to help protect the federal courthouse in downtown Portland. The building has become a focus of clashes since early July, when the Trump administration ordered federal officers into the city. Since that time, the officers have regularly used tear gas and impact munitions against demonstrators. While most protesters were peaceful, some engaged officers and caused property damage. An announcement of the deal indicates ICE and Customs and Border Protection officers will leave downtown Portland beginning Thursday. Federal authorities who normally protect the courthouse will stay. For NPR News, I'm Dirk Vonderhaart in Portland.
The Pentagon plans to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany. More than half will eventually return home. The rest will be deployed to other parts of Europe. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says it's a strategic move, but President Trump suggested this morning that it came down to money. He's been threatening to pull troops from Germany in large part because he says the NATO ally has failed to contribute its fair share to defense spending.
Germany is delinquent. They're at 1%. They should be at 2%. And actually, everybody should be at 4%, not 2%, because 2% is too low.
In Berlin, Esme Nicholson reports German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Trump's decision is a mistake.
Chairman of the Bundestag's Foreign Affairs Committee and senior member of Merkel's party, Norbert Röttgen, says the withdrawal of 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany will only weaken NATO, not strengthen it. President Donald Trump has repeatedly accused Germany of failing to pay its bills to NATO, whose members have pledged to spend 2% of their GDP on defence spending by 2024. Germany currently spends about 1.4%. Speaking to the Augsburger Allgemeine newspaper, Röttgen said the decision will significantly reduce the effectiveness of the US military, especially with a view to Russia and the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson. In Berlin,
four of America's biggest tech companies face some tough questions from members of the U.S. House. Today, the Judiciary Committee's antitrust panel has been investigating anti-competitive practices. But the CEOs of Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet-owned Google and Apple argue they're in fierce competition already, including with China's Huawei, a company now under intense U.S. scrutiny over alleged spying. President Trump, who has long accused big tech of bias against conservative voices, warned that if Congress failed to bring fairness to the companies, he'd do it with executive orders. Trump issued the threat on Twitter. This is NPR News. The Zimbabwean government has signed a compensation deal with white farmers who lost their land under a more than 20-year-old reform program. The farmers are not getting money for the land, but rather improvements on the farms. Ishma Fundikwa reports from Harare. Their dispute is still far from over.
The $3.5 billion agreed upon falls short of the $10 billion that some farmers expected, but the farmers and the government seem pleased with it. President Emmerson Mnangagwa spoke after the signing.
This brings to closure the issue of compensation for the improvements on acquired land.
John Laurie, who was part of the farmers' negotiating team, says compensation for the land is still to be addressed. The government refuses to compensate the farmers for the land, arguing that Britain, the former colonial master, should pay them. The British maintain that they bear no responsibility for compensating the farmers. For NPR News, I am Ish Mafundikwa in Harare.
Boeing is reporting a second quarter loss of $2.4 billion, according to the Associated Press. The maker of the now grounded 737 MAX planes says it'll slow production and eliminate more jobs. Boeing predicts the airline industry in general will take longer to recover from the economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Demand for travel has plummeted since the start of the global outbreak. The Dow is up 90 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom, N-O-O-M.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Born on the Bayou, with music from John Fred, Van Broussard, Don Rich, Fats Domino, Rod Bernard, T.K. Hulam,
the Harlem Shuffle!
Lee Kleinpeter with you for an hour of solid Louisiana gold, Saturday afternoon at 3 on KRVS for Born on the Bayou. Join me for an enduring and endearing hour of Swamp Pop and more this Saturday on KRVS, Born on the Bayou.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Back in 2010, the publishing world reported an impending sense of doom when it seemed ebooks might eliminate the traditional cookbook. Luckily, that didn't happen, and cookbook sales continue to soar every year, outperforming most other book categories. On this week's show, we've gathered together some of the best of the cookbook world for some vicarious travel. Culinary superstar Chef Sean Brock sits down with us to discuss his beautiful new tome, simply titled South. Then, Alabama-born expat Marty Buckley takes us to Spain's Basque region to introduce us to the food that seduced her to abandon her southern roots for a decidedly different kind of life. And Christina Quackenbush of Milkfish fame takes us on an exploration of Filipino food, a seemingly unfamiliar cuisine that eats like comfort food from home, no matter where your home is. Each one of these guests has accomplished the gargantuan task of publishing their recipes and stories between the covers of hardback books. So spoon in one hand and cookbook in the other, we're taking an international voyage on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Sean Brock, and my new book is South, and my new restaurants are called Audrey and Redbird.
Chef Sean Brock is a Southern food evangelist. For decades, he's explored the realities of Southern foodways through cooking that blends tradition with innovation. The force behind multiple restaurants, Sean is perhaps best known for being the founding chef of Husk in Charleston, South Carolina, which was named Bon Appetit magazine's 2011 Best New Restaurant in America. There you can order items like deep-fried pig's ears or deviled eggs with pickled okra and trout roe. His inspiration comes from the coal fields of Virginia, where Sean grew up, as well as his years of exhaustive research across what he calls the micro-regions of the South. In Sean's best-selling cookbook, South, the award-winning chef breaks down the essential elements of Southern cuisine, from cornbread to shrimp and grits, highlighting the regional differences. We met with Sean to discuss his book and learn what he's doing to explore the possibilities of Southern food.
Obviously, you're a Southerner. You're Southern born, and that's where your roots are. Would you tell me a little bit about how food became your life and how the South became your credo?
I'll see. I'm 41 now, and I grew up way back in the Appalachian Mountains near Kentucky in the southwestern corner of Virginia. In these rural areas, people still live the old-fashioned way. People grow most of the food they eat. My grandmother had a garden that was, if I were to guess, I would say it was at least 2 acres. And that was my everyday. I lived with her for a few years, and those were my chores, and I was always in the garden. Even as a little kid, I was fascinated by food growing out of the ground. I just couldn't believe it. And I would just rummage through and eat the potatoes and the cabbage and the rhubarb, and just fell in love with food at a very, very young age. And my grandma saw that and really started teaching me more than just making biscuits and making cornbread and the simple things that, you know, the kids get to do. When I think about what Southern food is, I think about the way her food made me feel. And that's what I strive for. And that's what I try and teach my team is this is a cuisine that is rooted in emotion and it's rooted in nurturing. And to me, that's soul food.
One of the things that strikes me about your new book, South, is that I think it has the earmarks of being a Southern food textbook because it's so all-encompassing. And you go into such detail about things that I never thought needed explaining, like the difference between cooking fresh field or butter beans compared to dried. Mm-hmm. Why is that in the book?
I'm glad you got that part of the book because I really wanted to call this a field guide to Southern cooking. And I wanted to create a book that allowed me to share all the things that I've learned through my insane research and development and my obsessive, compulsive nature of just trying to make the best version of these classics that I can. And this is, you know, 20 years of trial and error in these recipes. I mean, to me, that's what a wonderful thing to be able to share. It's where I start when I'm creating dishes, when I'm creating a plate of food for a restaurant or for my home. These are the foundational recipes that I start with. And the field pea example, I really enjoy because a lot of people haven't had fresh from the field peas just harvested. To me, those peas, when they are harvested and they just come out of that shell, they have so many layers of complexity of the soil that they were grown in. And each one has its own unique flavor. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of varieties. And in this technique, it's designed to cook them to capture as much vibrancy as possible, to capture almost the raw flavor. And the trick is to how do you get the depth of soul food and slow and low cooking and vibrancy at the same time.
Well, it's not just about ingredients. Another thing that you throw tremendous light on in South is cooking techniques that it's my guess a lot of your readers will have never thought of before or be familiar with. I love the section on fireplace cookery.
Well, that one was one of my favorite things to do for this book. When we opened Husk in 2010, I knew a way to capture the soul and essence of Southern food was through wood fire cookery and smoke and coals. And ever since then, I've just pushed myself to try different things every time I light a fire. For this book, I drew my fireplace at home. So I drew like these diagrams of the different areas and different techniques that I've done over the past decade with wood fire cooking. And I did it in a very interesting way. I had all the techniques written down, and then I just turned the recorder on my phone And I just started saying everything that came to mind about that technique and what I've learned and how to do it and what I would still like to learn. And then I had that transcribed and then edited down for that little essay.
Well, it's absolutely brilliant. And typical with what you're doing in this book is that there's this tension, this fabulous sort of connection between revolutionary and traditional cooking methods and ingredients. And so, yes, you pull the sweet potatoes out of the ash like everybody's been doing since the dawn of time, shall we say. But Sean, how did you come up with this concept of infusing with embers? I never have thought or heard of such a thing before.
That came from wanting to create a dish around s'mores. And I didn't want to use burnt marshmallow, but I wanted to evoke that sense of sitting around a fire at night and the way your clothes smell and how you taste the smoke. And I was like, how can we smoke ice cream? Well, you can't really smoke ice cream. And I was just like, why don't we just take a log that's on fire and throw it in our ice cream base and see what happens, which is just kind of a crazy idea. So we throw it in there and we wrap it really quickly, not knowing what's going to happen, and let it sit. And we go back and taste it, and everybody just erupts in laughter like that's a burnt marshmallow. And I have one sign always that I know when something's right was when it makes people just laugh.
Well, another one of the things that you mentioned doing in that fireplace cookery is hearth-dried seafood. Talk to me about why and why that's important.
I first discovered that on one of my trips to West Africa. And as I was going through different people's homes and cooking and tasting with them the traditional dishes, I noticed all of this dried, fermented, smoked seafood that would go in the beginning of anything that was being cooked, from beans and rice to a lamb shank, would be braised with dried seafood. You see it all in Creole cuisine. You see it all in Low Country cooking. You see it in all of Southern cooking. Is you start that base, foundational layer of flavor by rendering out something that's cured and funky and smoky. And then that starts to flavor the dish. And I realized, whoa, this is another example of how we as cultures were born to crave very specific things, because you start eating them at such a young age, and it's almost like a note, that smoked and dried seafood note. When those sort of dishes and cookery came to the South, we use pork. So now we use ham hocks and country ham and bacon, but it's doing the same thing. It's taking something simple and something unassuming like beans, and it's a way to add a very soulful, emotional element, because it triggers these nostalgic memories in your mind. And so it's neat to see how that also exists in other cultures, in Italy and France. It's just so neat.
You know, you've got a project that you're working on called Before It's Too Late. Tell me about Too Late and what you're worried about.
So my goal as a human being is to explore the possibilities of Southern food for the rest of my life. And in order to do that, I need to know where it came from. And what I've been discovering is the best information, the biggest aha moments, cannot be found on Google. They are not on the internet. They are word of mouth narrative. They are having a conversation with someone who's never measured anything in their lives, who's never even opened a cookbook, and never written a recipe. And it's that natural cookery that I just love. And I don't think our current generation appreciates it enough. And I'm afraid that it's slowly starting to dwindle away, and I just can't have that. So my goal is to take a field recorder everywhere I go at all times and a camera and just gather as many conversations as possible, as many seeds as possible, and just store it somewhere safely.
Why are the seeds so important to you?
To me, seeds carry multiple generations of wisdom. Wisdom that wasn't easily won. Wisdom that we cannot ignore. Not only do they carry incredible wisdom, but these seeds in their true land race forms are not only the most delicious, they're the most nutritious. And that's by design. And if we can get back to those things, we can get back to focusing on deliciousness, we can focus on nutrition, and we won't need all these crazy things that are happening with food these days.
Thank you, Sean Brock. It was an honor.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Sean Brock, author of South, Essential Recipes and New Exploration. Coming up next, we have a visit with Alabama-born expat Marty Buckley, whose book, Basque Country, is a love letter to the region's distinct culture and cuisine. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
Contemporary music from Celtic Roots is in store on the Thistle and Shamrock to complement those long summer days and warm summer nights. Take your radio outside and tune in.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
The spaces we inhabit shape our experience. From our homes...
Buildings are frames for our own understanding of our place in the world.
To our theaters...
Often the space is a really important protagonist in the process.
To the outdoors and even a dingy nightclub.
It's not just us musicians who do this. It happens in the natural world as well.
How spaces inspire us. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group. The Napoleon House in New Orleans French Quarter is now offering dine-in as well as takeout, Tuesday through Saturday, including toasty warm muffaladas, gumbo, frozen Pimm's cups, and more. They may be reached online at napoleonhouse.com and at 504-524-9752. And now, back to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Marty Buckley, and I'm the author of Basque Country.
When Marty Buckley was a student at LSU studying Spanish, she hoped the study abroad program would place her in a Spanish city she was somewhat familiar with, like Madrid or Barcelona. Instead, she was sent to Pamplona, the second largest city in the greater Basque cultural region. During her visit, Marty became seduced by the picturesque territory's distinct culture and cuisine, and vowed she would one day return. After college, Marty spent 2 years in her native Alabama, where she worked for Southern Living magazine and trained in the kitchen with revered Southern chef Frank Stitt. When she was given the opportunity to move back to Spain, she didn't hesitate. Taking her partner and 2-year-old daughter with her, Marty settled in the coastal city of San Sebastian in northern Basque Country. She was planning to stay for just 1 year, but has remained ever since. Just by skimming the pages of her cookbook, Basque Country, it's obvious how enamored Marty is with the region and its people. When we spoke, I began by asking her how a Southern expat has come to identify so strongly with an area of Northern Spain.
Well, I mean, I think in part, I mean, who doesn't like to eat and drink well and live next to the ocean and the mountains? I mean, it's just an easy, easy place to fall in love with, as anybody who has visited San Sebastian can vouch. But, you know, I do feel like there is an affinity between Southerners and Basque people. On one hand, kind of everybody else in your respective country is like, what's up with those people? So I feel like the Spaniards think that about Basque people. And sometimes I feel like American, you know, the rest of the country thinks that about the South. And then also I felt like very at home around the table there, because food for them is everything and it's very important. And that's something, growing up in Alabama and also having lived in Louisiana for a few years as well, was something very familiar to me.
There's 7 different regions in Basque Country. Would you demystify that for us?
Sure, sure. So Basque Country, as you said, is 7 different regions. 4 of those are in Spain, in the north, and then 3 of them are in the south of France. But Basque Country predates the formation of Spain, the country, and France, the country. So rather than dividing it by that, I often tend to think of it as divided by coastal Basques and interior Basques, because that's where the real difference comes in the traditions, in the labor force, and in the food. So the Basques on the coast, you know, they are eating a lot of seafood. They often work out on the boats. They use quick cooking techniques like grilling and light sauces, more influenced by the water around them. And then the interior Basques, the mountain Basques, those are the shepherds, and those are where you're going to have the long stews and the more meat and more dairy products, usually sheep's milk. And so that's where I really see the division, rather than modern geopolitical divisions like Spain or France.
You know, everybody, I think, thinks that that way of eating with little plates is really tapas, but it's really something different, isn't it? What's it called?
Well, probably the famous Basque export is the pincho. So pincho is not tapas. Tapas are from the south of Spain. They can sometimes be free. They're usually a plate of one ingredient, whereas the pincho is different. The pincho is also a small bite, but it can be, it's usually something skewered on a toothpick or served on a piece of bread, or even nowadays an elaborate creation with haute cuisine leanings. So it's, you always pay for it. It's usually a little bit more elaborate than a tapa.
Well, I'd never thought of this before, but I understand that in this culture, they don't really have side dishes.
Right. It's an interesting way of eating. So they're not always eating pinchos. That's kind of like a nighttime special thing. Usually they're eating around the table at their house or at a restaurant. And so there you get first course, second course. First course is usually a vegetable, usually just one thing, like a white asparagus, maybe with a vinaigrette dressing. And then the second course is the star, and that's the protein, and it's either fish or squid or steak or meat. And so, yeah, they just go one at a time, which is perhaps why their lunches are 3 hours long.
It is a wonderful way to dine and a wonderful place to be. Everything, just as I read through the book, continues to be so completely different from what we think of in Europe and certainly what we have here. Their shopping is very different, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's shopping there converts itself from like a duty that you get into your hot car and drive out to the supermarket to do into a pleasure. I mean, you definitely have supermarkets there, but you also have farmers markets and fish markets right in the center of town, right at hand. And you have stalls and shops that specialize in one thing. So you'll go to one place for your sausage, and then you'll go to another for your leeks, and then you'll go to another for your squid. And you kind of form relationships with people. And it's a really beautiful way to buy your food. And it really instills a respect for food.
Marty, the way you just described the shopping sounds a lot like one of their cooking expressions, something that they describe as little by little. So you're certainly doing that little by little sort of shopping. What is little by little when it comes to the cooking?
Right. So in Basque, that's poliki poliki. And they rely on fresh ingredients, and they don't add spices. They don't cook with herbs. I mean, we're talking salt, garlic, olive oil, and when they're feeling a little crazy, some parsley. So it's like, how does the food taste so good? Well, often they rely on a base of really caramelized onions, or they're relying on a long stewing. And so you have some quick cooking, but you also have some dishes that are based on a longer cooking methods. And it really is the time that's like the secret ingredient in a lot of these dishes.
Americans cooking out of your book, are they going to have a hard time with any of the ingredients?
Well, okay, so this book, I wrote it for the American cook, with the American cook in mind. However, I did also write it for the Basque. So I think there's probably, you know, four or five recipes that I don't anticipate people making.
What would those
they
be?
Just
like
had to
what?
Be
is it because they're just like too far out?
Well, in some cases, it's because of the ingredient. For example, the angulak. Those are baby eels. They're really not valued enough to be fished in America. And they are valued highly to the tune of $600 a pound. Yeah, so it's a special occasion food, and it's prepared very simply. An American home cook could easily make it, but it is a very local product. So that's one. And then there are a couple other recipes that I imagine might not be the most popular in the book, like the blood sausage, which is, you know, you have to have access to fresh blood to make. And it sounds very scary, but it really is so delicious.
Who shared the recipes with you? How did you learn to do this kind of cooking?
Well, it's a lot of eating on one hand. And then it was really an interesting process, because anybody who has ever cooked from a Spanish or Basque cookbook knows that they don't tend to delineate the steps as carefully as American cookbooks. So it might read, cook the fish, make the sauce. And if you don't have like a Basque grandma next to you, then you're never going to know what to do. So I did a little of research in books, but I actually relied heavily on a group of chefs that I knew. So I tried to get a chef from each province that I could, because I didn't want it to be a San Sebastian-centric book. So I had a team of chefs that I could call up at any time of the night and ask questions to. And then I also really had this group of retired old men that were very helpful. I would, you know, and there's like these, some of the dishes are more controversial, we could say. And so I would call them up and say, can I just watch you make cocotas or watch you make hake? And they would be super happy to make that dish with me. And then I would take copious notes and go home and test it out with my American measurements and timing and everything. And so it was a combination of both research and firsthand cooking with people.
Well, Marty, you've really got me confused, because I understood from reading your book that the Basque are really a matriarchal people. Mm. So how in the heck are you getting the advice on cooking from the old men? Would you explain this to me?
Yes. So, well, I should say I also had a group of, you know, friends' moms helping me. It was not just men. But actually, the very fact that the Basques are a matriarchal society and the woman has had a lot of the control in the household means that the men got tired of that, I guess, and they would look for sort of a refuge. And that really gave rise to these cooking clubs that started in the latter half of the 19th century in San Sebastian. And they became sort of a refuge outside of the house where men could go. And so there's been this whole culture on the side of men cooking and sort of competing to see who could make the best steak or whatever. And so they have men cooking as much, if not more, than the women.
Well, they actually do have cooking competitions.
Well, those, yes. Every village has a party, and every party has a cooking competition. And so you can literally hop from weekend to weekend to different villages and just catch all the different festivals.
Well, it really just does sound like a little piece of heaven on earth, particularly for someone who is a serious foodie, obviously we both are. Thank you so much for writing this beautiful book, because it's like a virtual trip, a trip into a really amazing place that I suspect many Americans are unfamiliar with.
Well, thank you. That was what I wanted. You know, that's the effect I wanted. And to encourage people to get off the beaten track and to show this culture, which is just so amazing to me.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you for having me.
That was journalist and blogger Marty Buckley, author of Basque Country, A Culinary Journey Through a Food Lover's Paradise. Rosemary Barron is a food, wine, and travel writer who specializes in all things Greek. Since first published in 1991, her cookbook, Flavors of Greece, has come to be regarded as a classic, presenting an authentic and definitive collection of Greek recipes. We spoke with Rosemary to learn how this ancient cuisine has survived and how an English woman became an authority on the topic.
I was born in London just after the Second World War, and I went to a very, very good school where I became very interested in Greek history and Greek archaeology, and actually even did a little bit of ancient Greek. So when I left school and went to university, my first interest was archaeology, and I ended up on the island of Crete in 1963.
What was Crete like when you landed there in the 1960s?
It was a very, very strange place. There were virtually no roads. There was, I think, 20 kilometers of tarmac road. There was no airport. And to go to the dig, the east coast of Crete, took nearly 2 days to get there. Now, if you arrived on Crete at the airport, it would take you probably 2.5 hours to drive. There was no electricity on the island. And in fact, what I realized just recently was it was about 18 years after Ansel Keys, an American. Ansel Keys was American from an American university, did an interesting study on the health of people throughout the world compared to the health of those in America. And that was because people in America were getting heart attacks and people in other parts of the world weren't. And Crete in 1947 had come out of the Second World War, desperately poor, desperately, desperately poor. And yet, 90-year-olds were working in the fields without heart attacks, which isn't to say that 90-year-olds should work in the fields.
but the fact that they could was pretty remarkable.
Exactly. And this interested Ansel Keys, and he put it down to the way of life there. And I only knew this afterwards. After I'd been there. But the place really fascinated me because I was digging and finding these incredible painted pots that the Minoans, who were the first civilization of Western Europe, did. And they were depicting the same kind of food on their pots in their paintings as we were still eating 2,000 years later, with the exception of things like we had tomatoes, we had potatoes, which, of course, are New World, but it was the fish. And the beans and the olive oil and the yogurt. On Crete, I'd learned there's a continuity in food, and it was extremely healthy. I felt better when I was on Crete than I did when I lived in London.
So the health, the great health benefits of eating Greek food for Zester Daily. Of course, you're very well published. You've been in countless publications aside from your own books. But for Zester, you wrote an article, 8 Healthy Food Tips That the Cretans Knew First. So explain who the Cretans are, because they were pretty ancient peoples, and what were they on to that we've lost?
You're quite right, Poppy. They're an incredibly remarkable people. At the moment, it's not totally sure where they came from, but what is pretty sure is that they were not a warmongering people. What we do know is they traded with the ancient Egyptians, they traded with the Phoenicians and the Babylonians. Their function was that they were sort of a stopping-off point for Egyptian knowledge.
So what are those healthy food tips that actually the Cretans had the scoop on?
The great knowledge that the Cretans had, first of all, there was olive oil.
Ah.
And our own scientists have proved that this is a wonder food, not only with vitamins, but of course in the old days, it also provided light, soap, everything. It was life. Life itself was the olive tree. With the olive oil, there were the olives too. There was there was what they called the sixth sense, which is a sense of community. And we all know that if we sit down at the table in a bad temper or with people we don't like, our stomachs get a bit knotted. What the Cretans understood, the ancient Cretans understood, was that the great human way forward was to eat in a community, to eat in a communal way, and at peace with others at the table. And that was what they called the sixth sense, and it was the sense that gave them the great digestion.
So, Rosemary, why do you think that those foods that can be traced back centuries and centuries to those ancient peoples, the beans, the various things that were being found and stored in those clay jars, why has that endured?
In some ways, I think it was a sort of one of these accidents of life. Greece has a very complex and interesting history, and it's also one of being left behind in the Industrial Revolution. So Crete itself became a place with this incredibly rich history, incredibly rich knowledge. Yet, in terms of industrial Europe of, let's say, 20th century Europe, was way behind. And what that meant was their way of life was essentially almost the same as it had been for centuries. There were some differences. Some foods from the New World had entered, tomatoes, potatoes, New World beans. But essentially, it was the same life that was being lived 2,000 years earlier. That is, the fish from the Mediterranean and the Libyan Sea to the south, the Old World beans of favas, chickpeas, peas, most especially the wild greens. And this was the same as the Minoans, 2,000-3,000 years earlier. And the pots that we were digging up had these beautiful motifs of wonderful octopi and shellfish and goats and greens. And we were eating these same foods. And I put it down to the fact that the infrastructure of the country was extremely poor. There were, as I say, no roads, no electricity. And people were living a life that was extremely sustainable.
That's food and travel writer Rosemary Barron, author of the classic cookbook, Flavors of Greece. Considering all the cookbook authors we gathered together for today's show, are you curious about what the current state of cookbook publishing and sales are in the U.S.? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that topic when we come right back.
KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Support for KRVS comes from 64 Parishes, a quarterly magazine on Louisiana history and culture by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. The upcoming fall issue will highlight Louisiana folklife, including Acadian brown cotton, duck decoy carving, Unisys Historic Liberty Theater, and more. The deadline to subscribe to receive the fall issue is August 5th. Details at 64parishes.org.
It's old, oh yeah, but it's still relevant. Things change, but not our love of gold. Music gold, for sure. And the vault is full on the Old Gold Show. Classic and time-tested hits. There you sit, all by yourself. Take that nostalgic trip with us on Thursdays at noon on 88.7 KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter. And I
thank you. Later today on This American Life, imagine if that's how you felt about your job and that this guy was your boss.
Today I don't feel like riding any rides.
This, by the way, is a staff meeting.
I just want to play all the games.
We go behind the scenes at an amusement park and meet the guy singing this song who is possibly better suited for his job than anyone I have ever met. Later today.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission, Louisiana's North Shore is turning up the heat for the annual Tammany Taste of Summer. Plan your escape to St. Tammany Parish for delicious adventures from August 1st through September 30th. Learn how to get your own Tammany Taste of Summer Pass by visiting TammanyTaste.com. Louisiana's North Shore, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. What is the current state of cookbook publishing and sales in the U.S.? The good news is the demise of the printed cookbook did not result from the dawn of e-books. E-books have not worked for users as well as traditional print cookbooks always have. In fact, e-versions of titles only represent about 5% of sales. After all, why would you have that expensive electronic device near all that cooking? Imagine what a splash of hot olive oil could do for your screen. Almost 5,000 new cookbooks are published in America every year. Sales of those books have been on the increase, with annual gains of at least 10%. In fact, cookbooks are one of the only genres in the publishing world continuing to grow. What's selling best? Regional and ethnic books are leading the pack. Sales of keto diet cookbooks are said to have increased 228% over the last couple of years. No matter what kind of cookbook you prefer, there's much to be said about winding down at the end of the day with a much-loved and trusted cookbook. I hope you'll give it a try one day soon. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Our aspirations, wrapped up in books, our inclinations, hidden in looks. Within the pages of the New Filipino Kitchen are a collection of 30 recipes and stories from expat Filipinos who have preserved their food memories and brought recipes from home into a new context. New Orleanian Christina Quackenbush of Milkfish contributed one of her own recipes to the book. She joined us in the Louisiana Eats studio to discuss her fascinating story and how the book came to be.
Well, Filipino food has been having a hard time with identity, especially now that it's been coming out all across the United States. One thing about Filipino food is it has so many influences. So even though it's the book is Filipino recipes, it definitely crosses the divides of race, creed, or whatever. It's definitely brought to you with stories that people can relate to. In all families. A lot of the authors there are offering their stories from here, trying to find ingredients here in the United States, trying to, have to pick different ingredients that they have to do because some ingredients can't be found. It's just been a journey.
Well, I just love this beautiful new book, The New Filipino Kitchen. And one of the things that I love about it is that there, right in the very front of the many stories that are told in the book, is my friend Christina Quackenbush. And the name of your chapter is Teach a Girl to Fish. And it tells the story of how you were born in the Philippines and how you came to America. Tell us about how you've made this life journey.
Well, at five, my mother met my stepfather, who was a Marine. He was stationed over there. So they got married, and I was so excited, and my mother as well is happy to move back to the United States. We ended up in the Midwest, land of corn, Indiana. So that's where I spent the next 15 years of my life when I moved there.
What was really so poignant about the story is that your grandmother didn't want you to go. She wanted to keep you.
Yes. My grandmother in the Philippines loved me so much. I was her my mother was her only child. I was her only grandchild. So we were pretty much her only family. And she was just begged my mother. She was like, please, please leave Christy here. And she called me Christy. But leave her here with me. I'll take care of her. But it was a very poor time over there. My family was very poor. And my
what
mom wanted
life?
Better for me. It was literally the commercials that you see on television where the kids are in the gutters. And that was my life in the first 5 years.
Oh, my goodness. And so you all came to America. You came to the Midwest. Did you see your grandmother again?
Unfortunately, I never got to see her again. Never. That saddens my heart more than anything. I received plenty of – she couldn't even read or write, so people had to read or write for her to send me messages. And she still, you know, till the day she died, which was just about 5 years ago, that she finally – that she still would tell me she loved me and she missed me and she wished she could see me. I never got a chance to see her before she died, and it's one of the biggest regrets that I have.
Yet – I can only imagine that you honor your grandmother and you keep her memory alive today in the food you cook.
This is very true. This is one of the ways that I, you know, pay homage to her and make sure that, you know, our family, even though we're in a different country that I'm representing, you know, where I came from. So the food that I cook came directly from my mother. I obviously didn't have any other influences of the Filipino food except from my mother. And also they were, you know, with American ingredients, so they weren't even, you know, like they should be. All the stuff that she cooked all came from her mother. And she wanted to make sure to instill, you know, these recipes and stuff in me. And so that's what I did, just growing up, like, what is this? You know, I was more into the American food. And so when my mother would make that stuff, I never really appreciated it then, never. You know, I mean, it was good, and I could smell it coming home, and I loved it. But I never really appreciated it until my grandma passed. That's when I appreciated it the most.
And the name of your chapter is To Teach a Girl to Fish, because that's a very interesting transition with Filipino food in the Midwest and the concept of raw fish. Tell us that story.
Well, in the Philippines, a lot of the people are fishermen. Coming over to the Midwest, I didn't get to appreciate the fishermen. But I did get to appreciate fishing because I grew up on the Ohio River with my American family, my American Irish grandmother. And we literally had a camp right on the Ohio River. My grandpa would fill a whole filter thing full of, like, crawfish for bait, and he would drop it, and all this fish would come up, and I would sit there just amazed. He would show me how to skin them, and right after he was done, he'd put a little salt on them, make them bounce around on the table and stuff. So growing up fishing, I loved it a lot. My mother always did this weird thing when we got the fish. She would always put vinegar in it, and I was just like, you didn't even cook that. You know, as a kid, I was totally like, I can't believe that you're eating that. You haven't even cooked it. It's raw. So I always wondered why she did that, and I never liked it at first. But, you know, as a kid, your taste buds develop. When I finally did, like, a light bulb went off, I was like, this is actually pretty good, you know. And I would sit down, and it would be marinated. She would have tomatoes and red onion and cucumbers and the fish all marinated in the vinegar, and we would eat it with rice. It was just a thing my taste buds were not used to or even ready for, but I was very very much happy, and then that just came in a development over time of the recipe I finally put out.
Christina, how did you end up in New Orleans, and how did food become your life?
Well, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to come to New Orleans is because, you know, if you want to be anybody, you want to go down to New Orleans where all the different food people are, the restaurants, the chefs. That life for me was just so glamorous, and I wanted it so bad. I actually studied and got a degree in computer programming, but did not like it. As I was going to college, I was in restaurants. So I came up in restaurants, and I just loved it so much, every aspect of the restaurant business, the food, the guests, all that stuff. I really wanted to make an impact and just really be part of the food scene here. That's been my whole point. And from the first time I've been here, I have did nothing but food.
Well, you know, and you really have created your own footprint. I think I first became aware of you when you were doing pop-ups at Marie's down in the Marigny.
Yes.
You know? So tell us how your path has followed.
Well, I mean, I have to give one person complete credit for my success. Well, not complete, but the biggest mentor for me, and that's Adolfo Garcia. When I finally came in to work for him and I was bringing food in, he's like, you know, we don't have anything like this here. Isn't that weird? And I was like, yeah. So next week he sends me an article from a restaurant in New York that's starting pop-ups. This was back in 2011 when pop-ups weren't really, you know, the thing yet. He goes, I think we should do this. And from that very first pop-up, it ignited in me like, oh my God, this is definitely something that I could do. I could go around and start doing pop-ups. And at that time, there wasn't very many. There was Pizza Delicious. There was the Wandering Buddha. There was very few. So it was a super exciting thing to do. And when I first approached Marie's, you know, their kitchen was no bigger than this room.
It's a funny, funny place.
It is. And it was just tiny. And all of us in the kitchen together, we literally were rubbing elbows. So it was definitely a challenge, but, you know, moving from spot to spot and to be able to make that space yours for the time being that you're there and to be able to put out really good food was always a challenge. Marie's was really a good stepping out point. That's when the neighborhood started coming together. Other restaurants in the neighborhood came down and said, why don't you pop up at my place? And so the next place was the Hudak Cafe.
Well, Christina, it is so wonderful to continuously find you freshly popping up here and there. Congratulations over the part you played in the new book, The New Filipino Kitchen. And I cannot wait to see where you pop up next. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Poppy. It's so good being here.
That was Christina Quackenbush. Milkfish is now offering dishes for delivery and curbside pickup. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum has reopened and is ready to welcome visitors into their newly redesigned galleries. Museum hours are 1:30 to 5:30, Monday through Friday. To plan your visit, call ahead for a reservation or book online. We hope to see you here soon. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by The Commissary, Dickie Brennan's latest venture, offering complete family-style meals featuring signature dishes from Dickie's other restaurants and DIY kits for home cooking. Takeout is available Thursday through Sunday at 634 Orange Street in the Lower Garden District. You can reach them at 504-274-1850 or visit online thecommissarynola.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.